It's the Mike Tech Show, show number 436. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me questions and suggestions for future show topics. My email address is miketechshow@gmail.com. You can leave me a voicemail message. The phone number is 240-949-2450, and that's Mike Tech Show, all one word, on Skype. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/Mike Tech Show. Send me a friend request on Facebook, facebook.com/Mike Tech Show. And don't forget the Wiki, MTS Wiki. That's wiki.com. There you'll find links to all the past shows and links to the show notes and downloads. Great source of information for the Mike Tech Show. Have a great jam-packed show for tonight. I have not only stories from the trenches and problems that I know you're going to enjoy, but last Friday I was overwhelmed with client problems, and I'm going to talk to you about them. I have some tips and some great email questions, and one question in particular I have that goes, it's really a multi-part question from a listener on the networking. And I'm going to do my best to answer all the questions. Still got a stack of email I want to get caught up on. Right now, a word from our sponsor.
Hello, listeners of the Mike Tech Show. I'm Lisa, the author of Call That Girl's Guide to Remote Support. Until the end of December, you can get all three of my ebooks for $59. To get this deal, just go to themiketechshow.com, click on the sponsor ad at the top, and click on the link, and you'll go to my website, and there you can review and learn about all my ebooks. Call That Girl's Guide to Remote Support, Call That Girl's Guide to Social Media, and Call That Girl's Manual of Operations. All three ebooks I have written based on my business model and how we do business here in Minnesota at Call That Girl. All three should help your business succeed if you follow along with the worksheets and learn from us. We appreciate your support and good luck with the books.
This week's Call That Girl's Guide to Computer Remote Support tip of the week: make sure you chit-chat with your client, especially remotely, because that'll lead to upsell opportunities during that session. For example, so what do you do for work? Ask when was the last time they had their computer cleaned? Because if you're just remoting in to fix a problem, this can lead to more opportunities. And remember the link to purchase those books, callthatgirl.biz/MTS. Click on the link in the show notes, the banner on the left-hand side of the Mike Tech Show website. Right now, Lisa has that incredible deal to buy all three books before the end of the year. So head over there. It's an incredible steal for all three ebooks. So the first story, I get a call after an incredibly busy day with problems, but I wanted to talk about this one first. This was my problem to close the day. An attorney calls me. They're editing a document, 28-page brief. Every time they go to edit something, it brings up the word in French. So they're going out of their mind. The document's supposed to be all English. Office 2010, I installed that. They purchased this on a laptop that they purchased from me. And it's a Dell laptop. The Office 2010 was supplied by Dell. I installed that. That was, boy, months and months ago. So everything's proper, and they have no problems with other documents, because once I sifted through getting to the root cause, it seems like it's just this document, and they were not the originator of the document. It was created by someone else. I remoted into their computer, and the first thing I looked at was, what's the language settings set? I'm going to give you a tip. Even if we don't know how the originator set the spell check and the grammar check and everything for another language, highlight the entire document. So I made sure to highlight the entire 28 pages. Then you just go to review and then pick the review language that you want. Pick English, click OK, and we watched everything that they were editing and everything changed to English, including all the markups on the side for the review. So we just had to go through the entire document and highlight it. They were so grateful. It was a great way to end a Friday on a very positive note when you solve what to them was very, very frustrating. For me, it was an easy fix because I realized what was going on and just something to remember, and I wanted to share that. But how did my day begin? Well, I was up late on Thursday night, and I got to be careful doing that when I thought I was going to be sleeping in Friday. I thought that I didn't have an appointment until noon, so I pretty much had the morning. Well, boy, was that a mistake. At 7 a.m., get a phone call, have an email problem. I was like, what's going on with the email problem? Well, no room on the drive partition that the Exchange databases were located on the Small Business Server 2003. Now, I had just been checking that literally a week ago, and there was enough room, but it seemed like they have a big influx of a project where everybody's storing these big attachments, and they had lots of things coming in that they needed. And space was always tight, but it was never that tight where it was critical like that. But when you run out of space for your Exchange database, it's game over. Everything's going to shut down. And I had two of these issues. One, the issue was that not only did they have this going on, but Trend Micro on the server, their backup of the database, it's just killing me on the server to the point where I'm actually uninstalling Trend on the server this weekend because it just sucks the life out of the C drive and it just kills the space. Now, I was able to change the page file on this, the D drive of this server where Exchange is, and we got 3 gigs back right away, but I had to reboot the server. So I went in, changed the page file to be the C drive where I claimed the space by deleting the backup databases from Trend Micro. Now I rebooted the server. We got space back, but I told my client, I said, I got to do offline maintenance to claim all the space after everybody's been deleting and cleaning up their mailboxes. You cannot see the space benefit until you do maintenance on a database. If you have a database and you're now cleaning up and deleting records out of that database, you don't get the space back until you do maintenance so it can compress. So with Exchange and the first link for the show notes for tonight, how to defragment Exchange databases, the ultimate article from Microsoft. Follow those instructions to the letter, and you will reclaim space. Now, I got 5 additional gigabytes back, so now we have 8. That's a lot for this small company. And this link details how to use the utility ESE Util. This is not for the meek. You make sure you know what you're doing and have server experience before you start embarking upon these utilities. But this is the utility I use. These are the commands. I perform this. I actually started doing a safety backup of the Exchange database, the private information store. What I do before I run these utilities, one, there was a full Shadow Protect backup of the server. Then after that, that backup's not enough for me. I stop all the exchange services and I back up the entire exchange database onto another external drive. Once I move that out, now, and I've copied it, now I know anything I do, I am protected. I can go back and I can then just copy the database back and start over or just leave it like that. But always do a safety copy. No matter how big that database is, take the time. So I not only did I do the copy, that only took about an hour. I was able to kick off the maintenance. Now, the maintenance is basically 9 gigs per hour. So the way I calculated, it was 5 or 6 hours. So I went to bed Friday night, woke up Saturday morning, and the maintenance was done. And I then copied the defragmented databases back over to where they're supposed to be located, started up the services, sent some test emails back and forth, and then notified my client that the maintenance was done. A lot of work, but it's worth it. And I wanted to share that because that was just one problem. So how about later in the day, just a few hours after this, I get a call from a client, outbound mail's working. Inbound mail is not working. Inbound. First thing I do is I look at where the exchange database is. And I look and they have like 700 gig free. Okay, we got a couple terabytes here. You know, there's 700 gig free. Clearly not a space issue. So now I go and I got to test SMTP, making sure port 25 is clear and free. I am testing everything. Port 25 looks good. And it's open and there's no issues with the internet provider. So why is inbound mail not coming in? So we go to the event logs and we find the error, the exchange error, that exchange MTA stack service stopped responding due to lack of space. And you're like, lack of space? The C drive. What happened here was, and this is where you don't want multiple people being an admin to the server. There's someone else in the company doing work with a test version of a program that should not have been copied to C. And they were doing work with this test database and the manufacturer of the software. They used C and took up just an extra 20 gig that they should not have been, that they should not have taken. They should have contacted me. I could have given them and carved them out a play area on the server to put that, but they ended up using the C drive. So that's why the C drive there just crept up and just took all of the space. And that should not have happened. Once I seen that and I looked at C and I'm like, oh no. And then I seen what was taking it up because I use tree size free. You can quickly identify which directories are taking up space. It's a great utility that gives you a quick snapshot of exactly what's being consuming the space. So I honed in there. I seen what that was. I just knew it. Contacted that person. I said, I'm moving everything to another location. Once I cleaned that up, I got the space back, restarted the services. Lo and behold, emails coming in. But at first, I thought something's wrong. If inbound email's not working, I really thought there was something going on port 25, and that was not the issue. So lesson here, make sure that you check the event logs. Uncle Al read the article and brought up a great point. This is the article to defrag the database. Well, you need at least 110%. So how can you do that if you don't have the space? Well, you're allowed to defragment to an external drive. And that's what I did. I made sure that our backup terabyte drive had a ton of space. Matter of fact, it had 600 gigs of space free. So not only did I copy the database, which took up with the stream file and the database file, we're talking about 60 gig. Once I had that in a directory, when you run the ESE command, you put a /T and then a drive letter of where you want the defragmented database. and I point that to the drive letter of the external drive. So you can defragment across, like the database is on one drive, but you can defragment it to another drive that has the space. Once you read that whole article, then you see you can do that. Great pickup. That was a great pickup on that article. And I'm glad you brought it up, because that's something that someone might think, oh my gosh, how can I run this utility? I need 110% of the space so it can properly defrag. Don't be afraid of that. If you got a nice big external USB drive that's got the space, you can do it to that. Then when it's done defragging, the defrag database is in a separate, on a separate drive. Now you're able to copy it back when it's all done, as long as everything was successful. This week, just a quick plug for Fabs Auto Backup for Tech. I had to use it 3 times this week. What was I doing? I was moving data from XP to Windows 8. Yes, 3 systems, 3 clients, ordered computers online on Black Friday, got them delivered, and lo and behold, they had Windows 8 on them, and a couple of them were like, oh my God, what am I doing with this? And how do I get my data from the one system to the other? Fabs Auto Backup, it's perfect. I just run that on the old system, get it to an external drive, take it over to Windows 8, and I restore everything. Here's the kicker. If you do not have a touch screen, the Metro interface, and I've talked about this, I think, a little bit in shows, and now I'm confused. I don't know if I talked about it in post shows or the pre-show or an actual show right now. So I want to get into this. The interface for Windows 8, the new start menu, it's great. I understand the way this is the future. They want to have everything seamless between their tablet, their phone, and the Windows desktop. The problem is, it's not that great to work with if you don't have a touchscreen. Yes, it makes perfect sense for the tablet. Yes, it makes perfect sense for the phone. But your traditional desktop, if it's not a touchscreen, guess what? You're going to hate this interface, possibly. So you need to Windows 7-ize your Windows 8. And I've done this for clients. And I'm going to read this one email, because he hits it right on the head of the exact recommendation. This is from Ken. Hi, Mike. I recently installed Windows 8 on my PC. It works great. But I found that I was lost without the start button. That's another thing. Start button's gone. I've downloaded and installed software called Classic Shell. It puts the start button back and goes straight into the desktop after boot up. It is free. It works great. Prior to that, I tried an app called Start 8. Now, I'm going to pause right there. Start 8, I love. It's what I recommend. But it costs $4.99. This software was better and had a great UI. However, I removed it because they were charging $5 for it. Oh, come on, man. $5. I know it isn't much, but free is better. Classic Shell works great, and so far I haven't had any problems. However, I was wondering what you and or your users are using to get the start button back, or if this isn't an issue and perhaps I am just set in my ways to want the start button back. He has the 2 links, one for Classic Shell, one for Start 8. Thanks for the great show, Mike. This is from Ken. Yes, free is good, and I just installed the Classic Shell for all 3 clients this week on these 3 systems. But for $4.99, the laptop behind me, which is running Windows 8 on an SSD drive, I have Start 8. For $4.99, I think it not only is the interface a little better, I like that just a tad more than the free Classic Shell, but either one is great. I want my crutch of having that start button, and I don't want that Metro interface start menu to come up first. Now, we don't eliminate it. If you move the mouse on Windows 8 to the lower right-hand side of the screen, you get the charms that pop up. Yes, that's what they're called, charms. The kind of a transparent menu pops up on the right-hand side of the screen, and you can go up to start, click that, and now you have the traditional Windows 8 start. But if you don't want to start off that way, these two programs, choose. You got free or $4.99. I don't know if there's any others out there, but these are the two best. I love it, and it works great, and I like having the best of both worlds, which is I want my traditional desktop, and then if I want to play with the Windows 8 menu, I can call it up and bring it up and play there. So you basically have two ways of looking at the programs on your desktop. You have the traditional way, which we'll call them programs. And then you have apps. They're different. Apps are the Windows 8 app that's made to run in the tiles of the Start 8 menu. Go to a Windows app store. Sound familiar? Like going to the Mac app store? Going to the iTunes? Windows is getting more Mac-like, so if you're in the Windows ecosystem, just like the Apple ecosystem where you have iPad, iPhone, iMac, or MacBook, now we got Windows tablet, Windows phone, Windows desktop, Windows store. So Microsoft's finally embracing all these things as they move into the future. I completely agree. They have to do this. So it's our job to make sure that you have the right tools to maintain what you want to, you need to be more productive and to stay productive. So if you want that start button and you don't want that interface popping up, guess what? We got the two solutions. So when Ken wrote this in, I was like, great, this is something that I've discussed and wanted to talk about, that these are my two choices also. So let me know what you think about this and if you've been playing with Windows 8 and your opinions, and I'll do a dedicated show. I put together a demonstration of a full presentation at the Philadelphia Area Computer Society last month on that very topic of Windows 8. And what was great, I presented right after Microsoft, where Microsoft specifically said the things you can't do and you have to do this. And as they left the room and they were done, I got up in front of the room and said, okay, now I'm going to tell you the real world. And remember how he said you can't run a program other than going to the Microsoft app store? That was incorrect. And then I started giving the real world practical implementation of Windows 8 and what you really could do. It was a great contrast presenting right after Microsoft. I really enjoyed that, and I know all the listeners did, and everybody who attended. I have a very long question that's broken up into multiple parts from an anonymous listener. And the first one is internet. Why a T1 or T3? Aside from the obvious symmetric connection, why do businesses so often use T1 or T3 lines opposed to cable, DSL, and fiber? Well, here's the thing, and this is some things that I put together and taken from different sources and then my opinion mixed in. Both T1 and T3s are provided by the phone company, and roughly speaking, a T1 is 1.5 megabits per second. A T3 is not three T1s. It's actually the bandwidth of 28 T1s. So if you have a T3, it's really 28 T1s bundled together, and you get the approximate speed of 45 megs. So cable, which is provided by the cable company, and nowadays typically falls between 3 and 10, but I'll tell you, cable companies now are going to, you know, 50, 100 meg, and now you have fiber, Fios going into this, like bursting up where they can go, you know, up to 300 meg down. You're getting incredible speeds at incredible prices. Years ago, they didn't have this offering. There was no fiber. There was no cable. The only way to get a dedicated great connection was a T1 and T3, and it was traditionally sold by your phone company. Those days are over. If you have access to cable or fiber, you need to get away from the T1 and T3, and you're going to save possibly thousands of dollars and increase your speed. Now, there's a reliability factor, and there's an uptime guarantee and a level of service that is part of the T1 or T3 that cannot compare to cable. Cable will never give you that kind of a guarantee of reliability. It has become more reliable over time, but you got to be careful and you got to do your due diligence of researching. If, let's say, Comcast is in your area for that business, or maybe it's even in the building because you're only a particular section of that building, an office. How's everybody else doing? Are they happy with their cable connections? Make sure that you get references and that you find out in your area, what is the stability and the reliability of fiber, of your cable company? I've never heard any reliability issues with fiber. And given the choice, I always pick fiber over cable. It's just a done deal. It's easy. I've never had issues with fiber in the business. I've had issues with Comcast Business. Oh, yes. And remember, I've told stories. I've also come from the corporate world where I had to deal with T1s all the time. And they say the uptime and all that. Let me tell you, with AT&T, with the T1s, I could tell you some nightmare stories. Depending on the area that we're talking about, in different parts of the country is going to have better service and reliability than others. I'll never forget having incredible T1 and fractional T1s and networking issues in Arizona, in the Glendale and Phoenix area of Arizona, because the last mile is provided by a local carrier that you have no choice. Even though we were contracting with AT&T, that last mile was Qwest, and it was the worst. It was horrible. It was just they were down more than they were up. It was very frustrating. So even though T1s and T3s are supposed to be more reliable, there's no guarantee, and it all depends on your location. And you're at the mercy of whatever's available in your area. So you got to do some research. So it's not so cut and dry. The easy answer is, if you have cable, if you have fiber, explore it. If you have fiber, done deal, do it. If you have only cable, then do some research. And if it's acceptable, then you go cable. Branch cache. Branch cache is supposed to cache network files to reduce WAN utilization. Do you have any experience with this solution? We would probably use branch cache in distributed mode because of our physical servers are in branch number one. He's drawn network diagrams and he has questions with different branches. There are many WAN optimization appliances that are supposed to do caching based on those files that are constantly being used and transfer. The problem is the first time you go to use any caching, it's always going to be at the speed it's supposed to be, and it's going to be slower until you repeat doing the same thing, and then the cache takes over and you get the performance benefit. So I don't specifically know about branch cache, but I will give a plug for a technology that when I was in the corporate world, I really liked, and for a WAN compression, and that was Riverbed. Take a look at the Riverbed solutions for any kind of WAN optimization. Firewalls. When should a Windows firewall be on or off? Always on. Windows firewall is on. If you need to build exceptions, build out the policy for the exceptions for the Windows firewall. Does this differ for clients and for servers? No. The software for the firewall that's built in with the operating system ever since XP Service Pack 2 and on, and for all your server operating systems, I highly recommend you leave them on and then tweak the rules for what you need for applications to work based on the ports that they use. And then you optimize the firewall based on the application. Should a domain firewall ever be turned off? Why or why not? Now, I don't understand your reference between domain and server. To me, it's the same. There is no domain firewall unless you're talking about the main firewall for the whole internet connection coming in. And yes, you need a separate firewall, and it depends on how many people you're protecting, how many devices. If you have lots of internet activity and you have lots of servers and you have lots of employees, then you need a bigger firewall that A, can handle all your connections, B, handle the traffic and the volume that you're going to be sending through it. So it's got to be sized properly for processor and memory. If the server, Small Business Server 2008, had a domain firewall off, what issues could arise? Server access is only allowed. Well, I don't understand what you mean by domain firewall, so I'm going to assume you mean for the whole internet connection coming in. If you don't have a firewall or a router doing NAT, your server will be compromised possibly in minutes. You absolutely have to have, at a minimum, network address translation. Your raw server cannot be directly connected to the internet. You have to have a layer of protection, a firewall, a NAT router. You have to have something between your systems and the internet. So I'm not sure where you're going with that question because it sounded too basic there. What about the fault admin shares where we have the computer name and then the drive letter dollar sign? That's a default admin share that's hidden. So only admins can map to the root drive of a server. What are your thoughts behind default admin shares? Well, first off, you need control of who's an admin. And it should be very, very small group that are truly admins. You leave them. They're necessary for being able to connect to the root drive of a server. They're hidden shares. They're locked down. They're only administrators. That's fine. Can they be disabled? Yes, but don't do it. Can their permissions be compromised? No, unless you give admin rights to someone or make sure you have strong passwords for the admin account, because if that gets compromised, yes, it's going to be compromised. Admin shares are necessary for you to not only function as an administrator, but some program, some software requires it. Private IP address space. I love this question. What schema should be used and why? And he has three different subnets. 192.168.x.x, 10.0.0, he should really go 10.x.x.x, and 172.16. You can use any one of them because all three of those subnets are what they call non-routable IP addresses. That means if they were on the internet, they cannot be routed. They are for private space only. So if you have a 192.168 out on the internet, it can't do anything. They are non-routable. If you pick these for internally, you'll be able to do everything you want on your network, and you're okay because it won't conflict with anything on the outside. Now, you got to manage these IP schemes properly. And you need to pick one, stick with it, and go all the way through your entire network. And I say, you know, I love the 10, but you're always going to be possibly in conflict with like Comcast. If you use Comcast, Comcast uses 10. 192.168 is the most common and rarely seen, but that 172.16, stay away from that right now. If you have to pick, pick the 192.168 or the 10. It really doesn't matter. And I guess that's the bottom line. All three of these are okay to deploy. But here is a great final question. My business uses a unique schema. Any ideas to why? It starts with 10.57. That's because an IT person that was consulting with them or doing something with them or somebody read something somewhere. When they start it, they just happen to randomly pick 57. I don't know why. It could have been anything in the world. But the best thing they did was have that 10 in front of it, which is what you want for private IP addresses. There's no reason. It can be 10.2, 10.7. Doesn't matter. As long as you're consistent and you follow through with the proper naming and the proper subnet masks to go along with the IP scheme that you're deploying. Great questions, and I hope I was of help to you. Let me know how you made out. Sorry it took so long for me to get that. That question's been hanging around for a few weeks, and I haven't had a chance to get to it because I knew I'd have to dedicate some time, and tonight just seemed like the perfect night. I do have some music I want to play, and I want to first thank everybody for using my Amazon link. It's crunch time. It's getting close to Christmas, only a few weeks away. Use my link, amazon.mikenation.net, miketechshow.com/Amazon. Share those links and buy everything that you want for Christmas. Amazon, you know the return policy is just the most outstanding that I've ever ran into with a company. And you've heard me many times talk about their return policy. It's phenomenal. There's just no company like it. You can buy anything, and their shipping is impeccable. I constantly buy from them and recommend them. Thank you so much for supporting the Mike Tech Show by using it, because when you buy something, your price is the same, but guess what? I get a commission, and it helps support the show. Also, in the show notes, there's going to be my Fabs auto backup for TechLink, which you can buy that incredible utility. And don't forget the Malwarebytes link on the left-hand side of the website. I love Malwarebytes Pro. I put that on a computer. That customer does not get reinfected. Don't forget, Call That Girl's Guides, 3 ebooks. She has an incredible price. Use my link. Go over there. Support Call That Girl. This Saturday, I finally get to go to the Smashing Pumpkins concert that was rescheduled because of Hurricane Sandy last month. And I'm going to be going there Saturday. I know I'm not going to hear this song. They never play it. Never play it live. But this was the first Smashing Pumpkins song that I ever heard. And it's a cover of one of my favorite songs ever written of all time. I don't think I ever played this in the show. Give a listen. And then I'll be back to wrap up.
Changing, 'cause I built my life. reflection around. And if you see my reflection in a snow-covered hill, landslide brought it down.
That, of course, Billy Corgan and the Smashing Pumpkins doing Landslide, which is one of my favorite songs from Fleetwood Mac and Stevie Nicks. That was the first song I ever heard. It's off the CD Pieces Iscariot. And it was the first time I ever heard that rendition on the radio that kind of brought me to the Smashing Pumpkins. And how I started listening to them. But anyway, I hope you enjoyed that. A little different. And you know how I like playing different cover songs from other groups. That is it. And by the way, I'll have a link to where you can get that song or that CD from Amazon. And I want to thank everybody for joining me live in the chat and for supporting the show, your email, your voicemail, everything. Just thank you so much. And I am so grateful for you being part of the Mike Tech Show family. From the bottom of my heart, thank you. And I will be back same time, same channel next week. Bye-bye, everybody.
You've been listening to the Mike Tech Show, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. Please visit techpodcast.com.